All right, let's go ahead and get started this evening. I'm just gonna apologize in advance for any coughing or I think Emily taught the ladies class on Saturday and she had some pretty good coughs in there, I hear. So might be some of the same thing. I'm gonna try to cut the mic as much as I can, but the plague kind of took over our household a little bit there. And I did want to say a quick thanks to Patrick. I don't see him. I don't know where they are, but he was totally ready to take over for me as needed, so I really appreciated that. We're going to be looking at Joshua 5 and 6 tonight. We're going to have to move pretty quickly because it's a lot of ground to cover. But before we jump in, let's go ahead and start with a word of prayer. God, we approach your throne at this time and we're grateful to you for the days that we've had, whether they have been good or bad. You have given us air to breathe, and you've given us opportunities to glorify you with our words and our thoughts and our actions. And God, we just are grateful to you for that. We pray at this time that you will open our hearts to this word, that we would see the story of Jericho for what it is, and we would not think of it as just a children's story, but that we would picture it as real in our eyes as we know that you tore down those walls all those years ago. Be with us and help us to learn what we can from this. It's in Jesus' good name we pray. Amen. All right. So chapter 5 is where we're going to start. Before we jump in, let's remember what happened last time. I always like to do the little, like, if you watch a TV show, they always have right at the beginning the last time on whatever. What did we talk about last week in chapters 3 and 4? What was the big thing that happened? Crossing the Jordan, right? And pretty miraculous way that they crossed the Jordan. The people crossed the same way they crossed the Red Sea. God parts the waters, and remember the priests are standing with the ark in the middle of the river, and they all pass quickly, and then the priests come out, and then all the water comes rushing back in. Kind of an amazing thing to happen. So all that to say, we start with chapter 5 and verse 1. As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted, and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. So all the people of Canaan are scared here. Where else have we seen that phrase before? Their hearts melted, and no one else had any spirit within them. I've already seen it in this book one time. Where have we seen it? Yeah, Rahab says that back in chapter 2. Look at chapter 2, verse 11. This is part of her speech we talked about a couple weeks ago. Verse 11 says, "And as soon as we heard it," talking about, Sihon and Og being destroyed and the parting of the Red Sea, "as soon as we heard about that, our hearts melted and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath." So, Rahab says that about the city of Jericho, but now we kind of see it as the entire land. That's what chapter 5, verse 1 tells us, is it's not just Jericho that's terrified. Everyone's terrified. Everyone's hearts have melted within them, and there's no spirit left. I kind of think of somebody being like punched in the gut, or you fall and trip and you hit your stomach and you get the breath knocked out of you for a second. That's kind of what I picture, where you're like, I can't breathe because I'm so scared right now. That's how this entire land felt. So God is working his wonders and showing the people that he's going to be with them. Okay, so let's go ahead and look at verses 2 through 9. Does somebody want to read that for me? I'm going to have to take a little voice breaks here, I think. So if somebody could help me out.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jacob. So I just want to pick your brains here. What thoughts do you have after reading verses 2 through 9? What do you find as interesting there? Yeah, way back 40 years ago. So essentially, he has led through the wilderness this group of uncircumcised people. How are they any different than the heathens in Canaan? They're really not, right? Circumcision was the way that God, what's the word I'm looking for, made a distinction between them and all the other nations. So that's cool to me to think about that God led these people through. He got them all the way to the promised land. He got them into the promised land, and then he sanctified them. That's when he decided, okay, now that you're in here, let's get circumcised. It's not, let's get circumcised and then make it all the way to the promised land, and then now, well, sorry, let's get circumcised, and then I'll take you to the promised land. It's, I'm going to take you all the way to the promised land, and what does he do along the way for them in the promise or in the wilderness that we're going to talk about in just a minute, the next few verses? Yeah, he provides manna every day for them. He feeds them along the way. He puts up with their stubbornness along the way, and they're uncircumcised the whole time. So I just think that's kind of neat to think about that God is long-suffering and that he's patient with these people. What other thoughts do you have on that? So he says to them, once it is finished, once the circumcising has happened, they remained in their places in the camp until they were healed. And then the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." What do you think about that? It's kind of like a renewal, right? Like a renewed covenant for them. Like, you've had this stain on you the whole time you've been in the wilderness. And finally, now that we're here, this is the last step. This is the last thing we're going to do before you are ready to go fight these men, fight the city of Jericho, and even do something more significant in just the next few verses here. So this is a pretty significant thing to happen, and it just really struck me as interesting that God waited to do this until they got into the promised land. He's already kind of given them that promise. So, any other thoughts you have on those first few verses? Okay, let's look at verses 10 through 12 then. While the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month in the evening on the plains of Jericho. And the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land. And there was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. So right after the Israelites are circumcised, they keep the Passover, which to my knowledge is the first time that they've done this in 40 years, I believe. I think that's right. And why I say that is because what is keeping them from partaking of the Passover? Why can't they partake of the Passover? What did we just talk about in the last few verses? Yeah, they're not circumcised, right? If you look at Exodus chapter 12 really quick, Exodus chapter 12, verse 48. Exodus 12, verse 48. This is God giving Moses the law, and one of the things he says about the Passover. In verse 48, if a stranger shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised. Then he may come near and keep it. He shall be as a native of the land, but no uncircumcised person shall eat of it. So you have to think that that means this is the first time they've kept this throughout their whole time of the wilderness. So it's kind of, God is starting to introduce this stability for them, this kind of idea of, hey, this is home. And what does the Passover make them think of when they partake of it? Certainly not home, right? That's God bringing them out of bondage, bringing them through the wilderness, and finally getting them to a place where they are home now. So I think that's a pretty neat thought to think about. What do you think about the manna ceasing? Just imagine for a second, okay? I'm 25 years old. So if I was an Israelite at this time, I would have been born where? In the wilderness, right? And what would have been my meal every day? Manna. For the last 25 years of my life, would have been manna every day, and quail, maybe sometimes. But manna, every single day. Can you imagine that? Like, that's your meal for your entire life. And then you get to Canaan. And what do we know about the produce of Canaan already? Yeah. Remember the two grapes that were hanging from the poles that they took back? So this is the best produce in the world. This is what people call the Fertile Crescent, right? This area where it's just life everywhere. There's so many good fruit and vegetables and whatever there. So just imagine being a 25-year-old, 35-year-old, whatever, your entire life you've eaten manna and you've lived in the desert, and you finally get to this place where there's water all around you, and then you take that first bite of fruit, you know, like that first tangerine or grape or whatever. Can you imagine, like, talk about weaning yourself off sugar for a long time, and then you finally have that first bite of sugar again. Talking about never having that in your entire life, and then you taste a nice, big, juicy bite of apple or whatever. That's pretty cool to think about. Not that they should have complained about God literally bringing bread down from heaven for them every single day, but this is the time where it's starting to feel like, hey, this is where I want to be. This is the real stuff. Like, the manna was great, and we're grateful for that, God, but like, this is it. This is what I want to eat on a daily basis. So how does that relate to us? Does that remind you of our situation at all? Go ahead, Danny.
They call this the Promised Land.
Yeah.
And it has shades of the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a long journey. We're strangers in a strange land. That's a foreshadowing of where we are.
Absolutely. Yeah, so would it be fair to say that right now we're in the wilderness? Yeah, absolutely, that would be fair to say. God has rescued us out of bondage, right? He's brought us out of Egypt, out of sin. And right now we're kind of just wandering. And we don't really belong here. We're just waiting for that day when we can cross the Jordan River, right? That's the song we sing about. On Jordan's stormy banks I stand and cast a wishful eye to Canaan's fair and happy land where my possessions lie. So these people have finally made it. Like, they're literally in the Promised Land now, and they're eating the produce of the land, and they don't need the manna anymore. So what does that mean for us? That means for us, like, God, I'm grateful to you for the daily bread you give me, for the bread on earth here. It's wonderful, and I should be appreciative of that, but it's not really anything compared to what's waiting for me. You know, that produce of the land, of God's land, the Promised Land. That's pretty neat to think about. Think about that day when you don't have to have manna anymore. You don't have to deal with the heartaches of this world, of a pandemic-ridden world, a world full of death and sorrow. But one day you're going to taste something that's going to be like, I don't even remember manna. I don't remember all the years of manna because look at what I get to eat now. I hope that sticks with you a little bit. What thoughts do you have on that?
Yeah. Like the difference.
Yeah, you don't need the stuff that's just going to fill your stomach anymore. You want the stuff that's going to rot your teeth a little bit, you know, or whatever. It's going to be, you know, luxurious. And that's what God is preparing for us right now. Right in here, we're just getting by and we're making it happen. But then once we get to heaven, it's, I don't know if I use the word luxury, but it's so much better on a higher ground, a much higher plane than what it is now. Sir.
This point, Moses was warned about this also, that you're going to get into Canaan and you're going to see all stuff you've never seen before, food you've never had, but you're going to, it'll be your downfall. They're not careful.
Yeah.
So it's almost, it's just that idea of what Canaan was supposed to have been, but it didn't pan out. But heaven will be the ultimate of Canaan. Once you get there, there won't be any.
Without a doubt. Yeah. The tendency was like, it's easy to feel grateful for your daily manna, right? Because literally it's raining down from heaven. And you have to go collect it. And it's like, if we didn't have this, we would die. But then for them, once they get into the promised land, well, it's growing on this branch. Like, what does God really have to do with that? Like, people were already, you know, spreading these seeds, and it's just already here. And it's easy to get that warped perception when really it should be, I'm so grateful for the daily bread, God. But then once I get the good stuff, I'm even more grateful because look at what you did for me. And I don't even deserve to be here. Great thoughts. What other thoughts do you have on that? I think there's me and Patrick both like barbershop music a lot. That's our kind of guilty pleasure. And there's a song he likes a lot called like Your First Day in Heaven, and talking about how cool that will be when it's like, time, we don't know how time is going to work and all that, but just that idea to think about where it's like, hey, this is my first day, and just looking around at all the wonder around me. And that's kind of what I picture here is, you know, that first fruit you taste, that first time you see God. One of my favorite verses in a song is when we all get to heaven. The third verse of that song, just one glimpse of him in glory will the toils of life repay. That's kind of what this reminds me of. It's like that first fruit, all those years in the wilderness, like, pff, who cares, man? I'm eating this giant grape right now, and I'm living life. Good encouragement, I think, for all of us. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Absolutely.
But heaven's wonder will not be for those who don't obey God either.
Absolutely.
It's sort of a parallel on the negative also.
So you have the people that are grateful and feasting on this, on the produce, and you have people that are, so we're going to see in the beginning of chapter 6, shut up inside and out, hearts are melted, spirits are gone from them. So that's the people that are with God, the people that are not with God. Great point. Okay, let's get moving. Verses 13 through 6, 7. And I know a lot of you probably have read this story when you were a kid and you've seen all the pictures and stuff like that, but I really, really want you to try to visualize this, because when I was reading this week, it's so easy for me to just think like, oh, this is a fun kid story, you know? Like, I like to sing the song. I can't even think of it. I talked about it a couple weeks ago. The walls come tumbling down, right? We sing that song and it's kind of fun. But I want you to think about this as a very real story, because it is. And I hope you believe that this happened. This literally happened. So so let's read. Start in verse 13. When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked. And behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, are you for us or for our adversaries? And he said, no, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, What does my Lord say to his servant? And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so. Now Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went up, none went out, and none came in. The Lord said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city. And I want you to just think about your reaction here, okay? This is your military strategy. This is what I want you to do to this mighty city. Okay, verse 3. You shall march around the city, all the men of war going around the city once. Thus shall you do for 6 days. Seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. On the seventh day you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat. And the people shall go up, everyone straight before him. So Joshua, son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord. And he said to the people, go forward, march around the city, and let the armed men pass on before the Ark of the Lord. Let me get caught up in my notes here. Okay, so what do you notice about those verses there? Just give me some things that you notice that you thought were interesting.
Kind of like with the burning bush. I always like that, the idea of take off sandals, your feet where you're standing is holy. It has nothing to do with the ground, but everything to do with God.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there.
Yeah. So that's a great point. Who does that remind you of? It reminds us of the burning bush, which I was telling Lucy about this story the other day, and I'm like, that's kind of a misnomer, right? It's really the non-burning bush is what it should be called. But anyway, God promises Joshua in chapter 1, verse 8, this book of the law shall not... I think I picked the wrong verse. Give me 1 second. Verse 5, rather. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. So this is an instance already where God says, this story that all these people know about Moses, about the non-burning bush, and about how God told him, take your sandals off. This is holy ground. Joshua's kind of being elevated to that same level here, right? Where he's getting a direct interaction with a heavenly being, and that heavenly being tells him, like, don't come too close, take off your sandals, this is holy ground. So I just think that's kind of interesting that God is already exalting Joshua up to the same stature as Moses, and we see that in the very last verse of the chapter too. What else do you see? So that was great, Jacob.
Well, the man that appears and he's asking, are you for us or against us? To me, that's another example of God will provide. Suddenly, here is this man says, no, I'm the captain.
Yeah, God. Absolutely. I think that's kind of funny. Are you for us or are you for our adversaries? No. Not for either of you guys. I'm here to do the will of God. Kind of a cool answer, I think, from him that I'm not taking sides here. I'm doing whatever God tells me to do. And Josh was very lucky in that he is on God's side.
I think this was more than an angel.
Okay.
You don't worship angels. Just like God spoke, speaking from the burning bush, he said, take your sandals off. This is holy ground.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with Abraham.
No, I think you're right. When we see angels in the New Testament, you know, like Gabriel at the announcement of the birth of Jesus, that Mary was going to have Jesus, it's always Gabriel said, and the angel and Gabriel said this. But here it says the commander of the army of the Lord, and then it switches right into verse 2, and the Lord said to Joshua. So no, I think you're definitely right that this is not just an angel come as a representation of God. This is in a lot of ways hard to understand it, but in some form or fashion, this is God, because you don't just take off your shoes, I would think, and it be holy ground for just an angel. Not that angels aren't pretty holy themselves.
Recurring mindset that they had, are you for us or are you against us? And it was never that way. It was like, God is for righteousness. And think about Assyria, about Babylon, and how they were not Israel versus everyone. It's like,
mm-hmm. Absolutely, because you look later, who's the city that's shut in and shut out later? The descendants of these people, right? Jerusalem. Look at some awful stories in the Old Testament of the siege of Jerusalem, and we talk about, I think it's like a donkey's head is being sold for a bunch of money because it's like, well, we've got some meat on this so we can eat it. You know, like awful, awful things that probably Jericho is dealing with right now. It's not, I'm for the nation of Israel, or I'm for the nation of Jericho, or nation, city of Jericho. It's, I love how you put that. I'm for righteousness. I am for people that choose to do my will. And that's so true today still. He's not for the Woodland Hills Church of Christ, I would say. He's for people that are working in his kingdom, right? Which we hope is the Woodland Hills Church of Christ. What other thoughts do you have?
The story reminds me of the flood of Elisha, servant, where mm-hmm. kind of pulls back the curtain and allows him to see the Lord's army there fighting. And I think that's what a gracious act for God to do that again for Joshua as he's preparing for battle here, to pull back the curtain a bit and help him realize, oh, this isn't my army that's fighting this. This is the Lord's army.
Yeah.
And I can take courage because of that.
Especially because, what do we know, like, what is Joshua's past? What is one of the things on his resume from his past? That's a really general question. I'm trying to get better at that. Military commander, right? He was the one out in the field for Sihon and Og. Right? He was the one that went out, and he was also the one, I don't remember what army it was, but when Moses had to raise his hands the whole time, I believe that was, I don't even want to say because I'm not sure, Amalekites? Somebody, some army, and he was the one out in the field doing it. So when God tells him, like, okay, I got this great military strategy for you, here's what you're going to do. You're going to take all the men, you're just going to march around the city. You can do that for 6 days, and the seventh day you're going to march around seven times. All the while, priests, you need to have pretty good lung capacity here because you're going to be blowing the horns the whole time around, okay? And then all the people are going to shout, and the walls will come tumbling down. From a military strategy standpoint, what red flags go off in your head? If you're just throwing out, like, they trusted in God, surely they trusted in God. Let's throw that out for a second. It sounds horrible to say that. But what red flags would you have as a military commander there?
You're unprotected.
Yeah, so I watched the VeggieTales Jericho one a long time ago. I don't know how many of you have seen that, but they've got the French peas, and they're throwing slushies over the wall at the people. But it kind of reminded me of that, like, there are probably people standing on the wall, right? Like, jeering at them, maybe, or maybe even, like, I don't know if bow and arrows were around yet, but something could have happened, right? You're leaving yourself very vulnerable when you're just marching around the city, okay? Takes a lot of trust, is what I'm trying to say, in that you trust that God is going to keep them so afraid that they're just going to be inside whimpering and waiting while you just march around the city one time. And you would think by the third or fourth day, they're like, okay, we've watched this once. We know what they're going to do this time. So let's ambush them or something like that. Let's try to pick off some of them, try to take down that Ark of the Covenant. But God has them so scared that they're shut up inside and outside. So certainly a lot of faith we see, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more at the end, but faith takes a big role in this. Any other thoughts on those verses? Yeah, that's very true. It's not like draw your weapons and be ready to do anything. It's really just march around. I was thinking about it today. It's like what did God actually ask of the people? March, walk, shout. That's your job. I'll handle the rest. And once the walls come down, you guys wreak havoc. But beforehand, the hard part, march, shout, walk, speak. Kind of just thought of this, but isn't that kind of what he asks of us today? Like, don't worry about the walls, just go around and tell people about Jesus, and the walls will come tumbling down because God is there. let's look at verses. Let's just try to go ahead and finish the whole story. I think it kind of all has to be read together. Verses 8 through 27. And if somebody could please help me out here and read this one for me. Or we can split it up. If you want to read half, that's okay too. Eight through the end of the chapter, if you don't mind. Or you can take half and I'll take half, if that works.
And just as Joshua had commanded the people, the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward, blowing the trumpets, with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord following them. The armed men were walking before the priests who were blowing the trumpets, and the rear guard was walking after the Ark while the trumpets blew continually. But Joshua commanded the people, "You shall not shout or make your voice heard, neither shall any word go out of your mouth until the day I tell you to shout. Then you shall shout." So he caused the Ark of the Lord to circle the city, going about it once, and they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the Ark of the Lord, and the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord walked on, and they blew the trumpets continually. And the armed men were walking before them, and the rear guard was walking after the Ark of the Lord while the trumpets blew continually. And the second day, they walked around the city once and returned into the camp. So they did for 6 days. On the seventh day, they rose early at the dawn of day and marched around the city in the same manner seven times. It was only on that day that they marched around the city seven times. And at the seventh time, when the priests had blown the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. And the city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But you keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction, lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it. But all silver and gold and every vessel of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." So the people shouted and the trumpets were blown. As soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. Then they devoted all the city to destruction, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys with the edge of the sword. But to the two men who had spied out the land, Joshua said, "Go into the prostitute's house and bring out from there the woman and all who belong to her, as you swore to her." So the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and mother and brothers and all who belonged to her. And they brought all her relatives and put them outside the camp of Israel. And they burned the city with fire, everything in it. Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. But Rahab the prostitute and her father's household and all who belonged to her, Joshua saved alive. And she has lived in Israel to this day because she hid the messengers from Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Joshua laid an oath on them at that time, saying, Cursed before the Lord be the man who rises up and rebuilds this city, Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn shall he lay his foundation, and at the cost of his youngest son shall he set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land.
Thank you, Kelly, very much. I think it's good to read it if we can, if we have time, because if I'm making no sense at all, at least we're reading the chapters, right? So I just want to highlight a couple things. We don't have too much time left. but have you ever thought about why God tells them to do it this way? He says, like, march around the city, and the next day 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 march around the city, and then march around seven times, and then shout, and the walls will come down. Ever thought about why he did that?
Are inside scared and shaking in their sandals, and then they keep looking out and they're like, okay, they're wondering what's going to happen next.
No. I think that's definitely a possibility. God is making it glaringly apparent to these people, right, that it's nothing that they're doing, right? I don't think the frequency of their footsteps around the city are somehow going to start, you know, cracking the rock or stone or whatever, and then it's eventually going to fall down. No, like, this is, you're doing nothing. All you're doing is obeying. You're obeying and you're having faith because God has told you the end before you've even done it. He said, on the seventh day, you're going to march around seven times, and when you shout, it will fall. So, yeah, absolutely.
It was an outer retaining wall where people lived, and this is where Rahab the harlot was. But then there was another wall that was a good distance away, built up on the top of the hill, and it was an even bigger wall than this. And so, you get on the internet, and see some pictures and stuff. But when that fell, they were able, the way it fell, just to walk on the rubble right into the city, and they burned it.
Yeah.
And when they excavated this, they found all kinds of pots of grain and rocks and stuff, and they're burned.
Yeah.
The excavations that they've done has confirmed what the scriptures say.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So it would be a massive undertaking today to knock down those walls the way this was constructed.
Yeah. 3 months of construction, maybe.
Yeah.
Get the bulldozer.
It would be, you know, you'd have to bomb, and still, yeah, the wall would still be standing.
Mm-hmm.
You might knock a hole in it, but it wouldn't call the wall to fall like what they've seen. There was very few rocks laying on top of it. Except in one section.
Yeah. So it's thinking about God's method for the people here. We've talked about how it's obey. And then I think he does it this way because he wants to give them an opportunity to show their faith. Right? He waits, not today, but today. You're going to do something different. You're going to walk around seven times, and it will fall. And I have told you it will fall, and you have to believe that it's going to fall. And you can just imagine, 6.5 now. Those guys are rounding the corner. They're on the last one, and we're about to ready. We've been silent this whole time that they've done this, but now I'm about to scream my lungs out, and I'm just going to watch it fall. Talk about an adrenaline rush. Seeing that with your own two eyes, those walls come down. That's a pretty cool thought. So the Hebrew writer even talks about this, Hebrews 11:30. We attribute it to God, and God should get the credit here. But I don't think we put enough on the Israelites, because Hebrews 11:30 says, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. I hadn't noticed that one before. You always notice the people, right? But this is talking about the Israelites here. The way that happened, the way God's power caused the walls to fall down, was through faith, by faith. That's pretty cool to think about. For people that are very obstinate and had a lot of issues right here in this moment, I think almost all of them, if not all of them, believed that that wall was going to come down. So what rich applications for us today, right? I mean, God asks us to do some pretty weird things sometimes. If I was God, there might have been some things that I wouldn't have chosen to write in this book or to have my people do, but I'm not God, and He is God. And there are some things that I don't agree with, but I do them anyway, and He works through that through faith. So, for instance, there would be like, hey, I'm talking to my coworker, and it's just not fruitful. Like, it's not going well. He never wants to talk about anything to do with religion. Your job is not for the walls to come down. Your job is to march, go, talk, and then just watch, right? Watch God do His work. And I feel like so often what we're doing is we march, and then we talk, and then we take a little chisel and go up to the edge of the wall and start trying to pick away ourselves. Like Danny said, we're not going to get anywhere with that. So may we all be maybe a little bit better at stepping back and just watching God do his, I don't want to say the word magic, but that's the word I'm thinking of, do His work, because He can. What is a wall to Him? What is a wall around somebody's heart to Him? That's nothing. Yes, sir.
In everything that we do for the Lord's work, it's the Lord doing the work.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not us.
Absolutely.
We're supposed to be the messengers. We're supposed to, that's our job, to spread the word, sow the seed. But God's will, God's word, reaps the harvest.
Absolutely.
So don't let us think that whatever you do or say is so enthralling that it just brings people that do it.
Yeah. But I will say, the part that's on us is we have to have faith, right? This wouldn't have happened if that whole nation, it probably would have happened still even if the whole nation didn't believe, but that was, just think about that for us. Like, we pray about our coworkers or about our neighbors, like, God, I know You're not going to change His heart, but maybe if You could just let me talk to him for something. You know, like, we should pray with belief that, like, God, I know You can change hearts, and I know You will, and I'm just going to watch You do it, and I want You to give me an opportunity to do as much as I can to help with this, but I know it's You. And God, by faith in God's power, not my power, but by faith in God's power, the walls come tumbling down. Okay, let's just, a couple things that we learned about God in these verses here. One thing I did want to mention quickly. Why do they not get the plunder of the city? They go to Ai after this, and the Israelites get to take whatever they want. So why do they not get it here? What do you think God is teaching them?
Kind of training them for the first fruits.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly it. That, like, now that we've entered the land, this is the first city we've conquered, but you don't get any of this stuff. You think it would have been nice for those Israelites who've been out in the yucky desert for 40 years to have some, you know, a nice piece of jewelry or something, but God says, no. I get the first fruits. Good example for all of us. I've been thinking about that a lot lately with the book of Malachi. We're going to be studying soon in the men's study, but think about that in your mornings. I think I've not been good about that lately, but your mornings are your first fruits of your day. And if they're spent staring at your phone or thinking about your day of work, that morning might be the only time you get in that day. God forbid, get in your car and die in a car accident, but the time you do have right now in the morning, who deserves it? Without a doubt, it's God. All right, thank you guys very much for your comments, and I think chapter 7 will be next week.